You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Geraldo Cadava, assistant professor of history at Northwestern University, on his book, The Hispanic Republican, Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Meanwhile, huge victory for human rights. The Supreme Court of the United States rules that LGBT people are protected from job discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This is huge. Meanwhile, Corona cases spike across the Sun Belt. Trump reverses on Juneteenth as Tulsa wishes it had no rally as the local COVID cases surge. Meanwhile, in New York, Cuomo threatens to shut New York City down again because of all that partying. And de Blasio says to contact tracers, don't count protests in that tracing of COVID. Meanwhile, the Atlanta cop shooting of Rashard Brooks is deemed a homicide. And the Republicans is or is not balking at ending qualified immunity for the cops. Meanwhile, SCOTUS lets California's state sanctuary law stand and refuses to hear challenges to gun restrictions. Donald Trump reverses the Obama ban on LGBTQ discrimination by healthcare providers. State polling looks good for Democrats in November, but local Republicans predict a Trump landslide. And finally, it wasn't Tiffany, after all. In fact, it was the niece. As Donald Trump's niece will be publishing a tell-all book in days to come. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. To the program. It's Monday. We made it through the weekend. Hopefully you did too. First off, let me just start by saying, send my best wishes to Mindy. Those of you who are members who listen to the fun half of the program, maybe you listen to it live. You are, I imagine, aware of who Mindy is. She's one of our, favorite callers. And apparently, over the weekend, she had a stroke in her eye. And according to one tweet I saw from her, that she is doing okay. She seems to have lost sight in one of her eyes. I don't know if that's permanent or not. But head over to Twitter. Go to Mayday Mindy number 9. Mayday Mindy 9. And send her, you know, well wishes. Mindy, I hope you recover quickly and to 100%, but I'm glad it is not more serious than you've told us. So please, best wishes and recover quickly. And hopefully she'll be calling in soon, to the program and, we'll get an update from her, but, hang in there, Mindy. All right, we've got a lot to get to. We've got some fun news, but maybe we'll save that for another day because we have a fun guest that we're going to have on sometime this week. I'm pretty excited about that. Also, well, we've got a lot of things to get to. Supreme Court, there are about 7 cases that we have been waiting for the Supreme Court to announce. One regards Trump's financial records. One regards the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and its funding mechanism, which is divorced from Congress. They fund itself via fees from banks, which has left it at least somewhat autonomous from a Republican Congress that wants to destroy it. Obviously, when a Republican controls the executive branch, they can put someone like Mick Mulvaney in there and attack it that way. But structurally, still protected. There's a case that we are anticipating on the question of DACA. There is a case about an abortion law in Louisiana that is clearly a trap law, but we're going to see if trap laws are now okay. Trap laws being laws that are specifically structured to make it almost impossible to get an abortion, if not in practice, impossible. The court has ruled on this in the past, a case in Texas, but it's a different court now. There's also a case regarding faithless electors that is in the context of the Electoral College. Can Electoral College voters cast their ballots for someone who did not win a majority of their state's popular vote? That's the question there. Religious exemption from discrimination suits. Just a question of whether if you claim that you're religious or pass some type of religious test, whether you can do things that are discriminatory and without any type of accountability. And the final one was one that we got a report on, or we got a ruling this morning. I mean, just moments before the show started. And, you know, I have not had a chance to read into the decision, but it is a 6-3 decision, and the top line is this. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, bars job discrimination because of sex and race, religion, I think marital status, and today the Supreme Court found. And prior to this, understand that there was no protection. And this also exists in the context of housing. And I don't know if this decision involves housing as well. I got to look into that. It appears to be a job discrimination, but I'm not sure. I just haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. And we're going to talk, obviously, to an expert on this. But prior to this, and I don't think many people knew this, in the vast majority of states, vast majority, at least half, I think, of the states in this country, you could be fired from your job because you were gay. Period. That was yesterday. Unless your state had a specific statute that said you cannot be fired because of your sexual orientation, you could be fired. If your boss finds out that you're gay and it's like, I don't like gay people, you're fired. Well, now there is a federal constitutional prohibition, or I should say a statutory, federal statutory prohibition, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prevents the firing of people because of their sexual orientation or whether they're transgender. So this is a big deal. This is a really big deal. It is, I don't even know how to absorb good news these days, but it's great news and worthy of celebration. Meanwhile, the Trump administration just 2 days ago, I think on Friday, reversed a ban that had been put in place by the Obama administration of healthcare providers discriminating against people because they're LGBTQ. In other words, I as in my religion. I don't believe that that I believe that it's a sin to be gay. And I also am a doctor, or I'm a pharmacist, and I refuse to treat this person. I don't care. I work in an ER, but I don't care that this person needs their insulin. Just not going to do it. And the Obama administration issued a ban on discrimination on those grounds by healthcare providers. Donald Trump has reversed it in an attempt to shore up his evangelical base. So there it is. But the good news is there is a, and it's unclear at this point, at least to me, how broad the implications of what the Supreme Court ruled in regards to the Civil Rights Act will be. It is hard to imagine that the Civil Rights Act says you can't discriminate based upon sexual orientation in the context of hiring or firing, but not in terms of housing, or not in terms of providing people medical service. We will see, and we will be talking to somebody about this Supreme Court case and others probably this week and probably again next week, depending on when these cases come out. So good day, at least for human rights. In this, let's take the good news. It's good. Just a couple of ad reads before we get to our guest. Every day you see me here, I've got two cups on my my desk now. One is just coffee, but the other is the matcha flavor from Liquid IV. Proper hydration, crucial for your immune system, can boost your immunity. Liquid IV has an easy, healthy solution for dehydration. Liquid IV has more vitamin C than an orange, has as much potassium as a banana. It's packed with vitamins B3, B5, B6, B12, vitamins that are known to help your body defend against infections and made effective through cellular transport technology. One serving of Liquid IV provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water alone. It's healthier than sugary sports drinks. There's no artificial flavors. There's no artificial preservatives. There's less sugar than an apple. Plus, Liquid IV is donating 2.3 million servings in response to COVID-19 with products being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, veterans, and active military. Look, they have ones that'll boost your immunity. They have ones that'll provide better sleep. They have better workouts, better energy. For me, I mean, there's a bunch of different flavors, and I've tried them all, and I have all of them, and I use them, you know, relatively regularly. But my go-to every day is the matcha. I don't know if you can see that it's green in there, but it's delicious energy drink, and it keeps me hydrated. Very important. Liquid IV is available nationwide at Target, Whole Foods, and Costco. Or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order with promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Get better hydration today at liquidiv.com, promo code MajorityRep. You can also find them, like I say, at Target, Whole Foods, Costco. Also, remember, as we're starting to see infections rise in certain parts of the country, those places which have practiced proper social distancing and have been careful, things are going down. But for all our sakes, we need to avoid crowds these days. What if you need to go to the post office? What if you need postage to send out letters and packages? Stamps.com is here to help. Stamps.com, you can print postage on demand. You can skip the lines and crowds at the post office. You personally print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, for any package, for any class of mail going anywhere. Then you just leave it for your mail carrier, just like you would with any other package for the mail. You schedule a free package pickup or drop it in a mailbox. No human contact required. Whether you're a small business sending invoices, an online seller shipping out products. You're working from home, you just need to mail stuff. You're stuck at home, you just need to mail stuff. Stamps.com can handle it with ease. Stamps.com, you get great discounts too. 5 cents off of every first class stamp, up to 62% off of shipping costs. And now Stamps.com also offers UPS services with discounts up to 62%. You won't even have to pay UPS residential surcharges. Right now, you get a special offer for our listeners. 4 week trial plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's Stamps.com. Enter Majority Report. We will put links to both those ads in the show notes today and in the podcast description, the YouTube description, all of it. Let's play a quick video before we do. Look, this is childish. I'm going to say that right up front. Everybody knows Donald Trump is afraid of steps. So all this talk about how he had trouble drinking and how he's like tiptoeing down the steps, I don't think he's having some type of episode. I think the guy's nuts anyways. But I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I do know, very funny to watch Donald Trump so terrified of a ramp. Well, let's play this clip. I mean, because Brendan, Matt, help me out here. When Anthony Antomerick did the president show, he kept making fun of the fact that Donald Trump is afraid of steps.
Right. Right?
I mean, he's well known for that, right? Like, he's nervous about stepping down.
The famous hand holding with Theresa May comes to mind early on in his presidency.
And the
escalator started the whole thing. It was an escalator.
That's right.
That's true.
He's afraid. I never thought about that. Interesting. But here he is having to go down a ramp. And, you know, the only thing that scares me is you remember when the story about him going into the bunker when there were protests came out. He has to come out the next day and basically tear gas and fire canisters at people and bullets covered with rubber at people as a way of making himself feel macho again. I hope that he doesn't respond in some type of way to make up for the fact of how, like, sort of feeble he seems here. That music. And apparently he had trouble drinking a glass of water as he was forcing all these students to come back and listen to his commencement speech. I love the fact that he gave that commencement speech and the only thing that people are aware of is the fact that he had to tiptoe down the ramp. That I really appreciate. I feel like we should play that just when we want to cheer ourselves up, although the SCOTUS decision is pretty pretty good. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Geraldo Cadava. He is a professor of history at Northwestern University, author of The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. We'll be right back after this. You gonna play some music?
Sorry, 1 second.
We'll be right back.
pleasure to welcome to the program Geraldo Cadava. He is an associate professor of history at Northwest University and author of the newly released The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Geraldo, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Let me just start with this, and then we'll just start more or less with a couple of questions I had that just emanate out of the title. Hispanic versus Latino. Latino, my understanding is Latino refers to people coming from Latin America. Hispanic refers to people who speak Spanish. Why Hispanic Republican as opposed to Latino Republican?
Well, you have asked the kind of central question in all of Latino history, who or what is a Latino or a Hispanic? So Hispanic is certainly the term preferred by Republicans. Republicans today are kind of okay with the term Latinos, like Trump's campaign team is called Latinos for Trump. So term shifts. I think you're right that Hispanic has had to do with spoken Spanish, but it also has to do with a kind of hearkening back to the Spanish Empire and a kind of reverence for and pride in Spanish heritage. I think that has something to do with it. It's still the term preferred by Hispanics or Latinos in particular areas, like New Mexico is the kind of classic example for embracing the term Hispanic or Hispano even. So part of it has to do with geography. Part of it has to do with updating terms to reflect the times. Part of it has to do with political sensibilities. And I would say that Hispanic is certainly the term preferred by Republicans. It's certainly the term that will get you into the least trouble if you apply it to them.
And is that different from Democrats?
I would say so. I mean, in the broadest of terms, again, it has to do with geography in some cases. So I think, Democratic Latinos or Hispanics might call themselves Hispanics in certain parts of the country. But I think broadly, I would feel comfortable saying that most Democrats refer to themselves as Latinos.
Okay.
Even embracing the term Latinx, which
right.
is the farthest from what Hispanic Republicans would do.
Okay, and so let me ask you, why start with Nixon as opposed to any other time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first two chapters are actually about the early efforts by the Eisenhower and Goldwater campaigns to recruit Hispanics, but it really takes off with the Nixon administration because he, during his reelection in 1972, is the first Republican candidate to win approximately 30-35% of the Hispanic votes compared with all other Republican candidates who won in the single digits. And since 1972, the result for Republicans has been much closer to the 30-35% that Nixon has won than to the single digit support they won since then. So I really do think the Nixon administration is the kind of turning of the tide.
And it's actually not even the administration as much as it is the candidacy, right? I mean, the argument that you make in the book is that, or one of them, is that the Hispanic, I guess, to the extent that there is a Hispanic relationship with the Republican Party, one third of Hispanics, approximately, it changes, went from an affinity for the man in Nixon and Reagan into an affinity for the party. Let's start with what was it about Nixon and I guess Reagan, really? Those are the two Republicans we're talking about. So the first two after Nixon, or including Nixon, I guess. What was it about them that built this relationship with the Hispanic voter?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot happening in the late 60s, early 70s. And, I'll start there and say that beginning in the early 1960s, African Americans are kind of fleeing from the Republican Party in droves after the Republican Party, and Barry Goldwater in particular, takes a strong stand against civil rights. And Nixon, his presidential campaigns, his reelection campaign, is very explicit about the fact that they need to replace those lost votes. And the demographic they turn to is Hispanics, first and foremost. So that's happening. The other thing I think that's going on is that Nixon and Reagan have these Western identities, and they claim familiarity with the Mexican-American community in California in particular, as the basis of their outreach to Hispanics nationally. And so, you know, Nixon himself has this kind of origin story of growing up in the fields, the agricultural fields near Whittier, California, south east of Los Angeles, and how he came into contact with Mexican Americans then. And Reagan has a very similar story. He's from Illinois, of course, but he spends kind of formative years in California, and talks a lot in the late 60s and 70s about how, as the governor of California, he appointed more Mexican Americans to his gubernatorial administration than any of his 20th century predecessors. So what happens when Reagan starts to run for president in the late, well, I guess the time he actually wins in the late 1970s, in the lead up to the 1980 election, is his Hispanic supporters start saying to other Hispanics as an effort to recruit them, you know, we know that the Republican Party hasn't always supported our community's interests, but here you have this man, Ronald Reagan, a Western governor, the governor of California, who really stands for us and represents our interests. So why don't you take a look at him and vote for Reagan, the man, not the Republican Party? And that logic actually shifted by the early 21st century to supporting the Republican Party over individual candidates like Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, was the pitch just based upon Reagan is appointing Mexican Americans to positions out of California? I mean, was there material benefits that Reagan was providing?
Or that's Nixon, a great question.
Or Nixon, I mean, for that matter?
That was, I think that was the basis of his pitch. That's how he got, say, Cubans in Florida or Puerto Ricans in New York to listen to the pitch that he has a longstanding familiarity with Hispanic communities. But yes, I mean, this is kind of my grandfather's story, actually. He served in the military, then retired, you know, in the 1960s, worked at a golf course washing dishes and worked in silver mines, and then voted Democrat up until 1980, when for the first time he voted for Ronald Reagan, because at the time he was working as a silver miner in the Silver Bell mine in Arizona near Tucson. And Reagan was promising to put more money back into his biweekly paycheck because of tax cuts. So this is why my grandfather voted for a Republican for the first time. But then what interested me about my grandfather's experience is how he then kind of embraced the Republican Party wholesale in the years afterwards on everything from immigration control to welfare to you name it.
That's interesting. How much did, you know, I mean, the story that I've always heard, and this I think probably came out of like the efforts for George W. Bush trying to build bridges in the Hispanic community, was that basically about social conservatism, that Hispanic Latino voters tended to be more socially conservative when it came to things like gender roles, like things like abortion, et cetera, et cetera. Is that, is there any truth to that? I mean, or is how much did that play? You know, because I don't know. I mean, I guess abortion becomes an issue in 1973, and I just wonder how much of that was actually in play, or how much of that was just more of a story?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of the story, but I don't think it's the only part of the story. I think that, you know, the issue of abortion has become much more politicized in the fairly recent past, I'm thinking over the past couple of decades, than it was in the 1970s or early 80s. So I will say that, you know, Nixon's pitch and Reagan's pitch to Hispanics had very little to do with abortion in particular. It did have to do with, you know, broadly some sense of family values. But I think one thing I'm trying to do in my book is pay attention to these individual issues like abortion or religious values or family values. But I'm also trying to look at a bigger picture. When I was talking to colleagues, friends about the book I was writing, the first two things they always said was, were, well, you must be paying a lot of attention to Cubans and a lot of attention to Catholicism. And my answer was always like, yeah, well, that's part of it, but it's certainly not all of it. And I think that if you try to just put it in those boxes of Cuban exile politics or Catholicism, you're really missing a bigger picture. And it makes it seem like a complete surprise when someone like Trump wins 28-29% of the Hispanic vote. So, you know, I think Catholicism, Cuban exile politics, abortion, other social issues, that's part of it. But I think, you know, some sense of U.S. Latin American relations more broadly has a lot to do with it. I think military service and patriotism has a lot to do with it. I think free enterprise and kind of pro-capitalism has a lot to do with it. So I think it's a kind of much more diverse and complicated history than just social values and social issues like abortion.
When did that when did the dynamic, I mean, you described it in the context of your grandfather, but I know that's also sort of like, you know, just illustrative of what you found broadly speaking. When did that turn from we're voting for the guy despite the Republicans to we're voting for the Republicans despite the guy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a lot of it has to do with shifting debates about immigration in the 1990s. I think a lot of it has to do with the kind of rise of nativism within the Republican Party, even in the, you know, earlier in the 1980s. You know, I'm thinking about things like the founding of the group U.S. English, which was a national effort to try to pass a constitutional amendment to make English the official language of the United States. That was a group that had in fact spun out of John Tanton's Federation for American Immigration Reform, a kind of nativist zero population group based in Michigan, but which was also national. And then the rise of people like Pat Buchanan in the late 80s, but then he went on to run a fairly successful primary challenge to George H.W. Bush in 1992. So, you know, I think the rise of nativism within the Republican Party, the move to the right of the Republican Party in the early 1990s on immigration and border control as an issue, that really forced Hispanic Republicans to justify their support for the Republican Party, their continued support for the Republican Party, despite the party's move on issues that many assumed really mattered to Hispanics.
But wait, so I'm confused. So like how, if, so they're interested in Reagan because of tax cuts. I mean, is that really, I mean, is that, how does that track with, let's say, you know, just Reagan, so-called Reagan Democrats? I mean, I mean, I think there's increasing evidence that at least a certain percentage of those Reagan Democrats were a function of, you know, the long process of LBJ saying we're going to lose a certain percentage of the country. I think he said the South, but you know, I recently, maybe it was maybe a year ago. I can't remember the book. The book escapes me for a moment, but there was a fact in there that even as late as 2008, 50% of non-college educated whites did not perceived the Republican Party to the left of Democrats on race. And it wasn't until the election of Barack Obama that, that corrective, it was Identity Crisis, I think was the book.
Wow.
And so, I mean, I wonder like how much of, is the phenomena of the Reagan Democrat distinct mm-hmm. or consist, you know, distinct or, you know, like just running in parallel to increase Latino support? Or is it just is it distinct or is it in some way related?
No, I think it does run parallel. I mean, I brought up taxes as the first issue that my grandpa, in recounting his movement toward the Republican Party, talks about. But I think there was a lot else going on with Reagan as well. I mean, he was the first Republican president to really win massive, widespread support from Cubans because of his strong, you know, anti-communist posture. So even Jimmy Carter in 1976 won like 50% of the Cuban American vote in Florida, and Reagan in his two elections in 80 and 84 won, you know, 80-90%. Mm-hmm. So he was the first Republican to really just sweep up in Florida. And that's part of it. That's in addition to the tax story. But, you know, Reagan, even as this, you know, nativism was rising within the Republican Party, he himself didn't go along with that. I mean, in his campaign in 1980, he called Mexico the closest ally of the United States. When he met with the Mexican president, Jose Lopez Portillo, he said he didn't think that there needed to be a border wall between the United States and Mexico. There needed to be more cooperation between the United States and Mexico and more exchange. So Mexican Americans didn't see him as someone who, you know, was part of that nativist move within the Republican Party. And then he also advocated for the Immigration Reform and Control Act in 1986, which at the same time that it included kind of punitive measures like employer sanctions, it also led to the naturalization of 2 million, 2 million Latin American immigrants. So I think Hispanic Republicans really supported that. So I mentioned taxes because it you know, is right. most closely related to my grandfather's story. But I think there was a whole range of issues that he also supported statehood for Puerto Rico. I think that really spoke to Puerto Ricans as well. So it was a much broader phenomenon, I think.
I want to just put a pin in that because it's still sort of like, it's still unclear. Like all the things you just listed are almost diametrically opposed to what Donald Trump is doing, right? Like,
I mean,
almost every totally. Single one of those things is almost violently diametrically opposed to what Donald Absolutely. Trump is doing. And yet, but before we get there, there was one other thing that, you know, is while, you know, just sort of like, temporally while we're talking about Reagan and we're talking about, mm-hmm. Is that you wrote that it's basically almost like a Republican tradition at this point to name the treasurer not the treasury secretary but the treasurer
right.
of the United States right. To be a Hispanic woman. What's the behind that?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? It's an interesting fact that, you know, the dollars that Americans carried around in their pockets in the 70s and 80s all had the signatures of Mexican-American Republican women. And the first was during the Nixon years with Romana Acosta Bañuelos. The second was Catherine Ortega under Reagan. The third was Catalina Vasquez Villalpando under George H.W. Bush. So, you know, the treasurer of the United States is a largely symbolic position. They sign the currency, oversee the mint, things like that. But it's and in some ways it was also a symbolic appointment. And it was part of the Hispanic outreach effort, especially in the run up to elections. And so the idea was that they would choose Hispanic Republican women who were kind of seen as leaders in their communities to essentially be surrogates. I mean, surrogates on the campaign trail for Republican presidents and presidential candidates. So they would, you know, go and campaign. And in some cases, they were given a lot of credit for really boosting the Hispanic Republican support for Republican presidential candidates in states like New Mexico or California. And so it was largely symbolic. It was seen as kind of helpful as a measure of recruiting Hispanic voters. And I would say in some ways, it's kind of really symbolic of a Republican strategy with Hispanics. It's much more like top down, you know, where you would have these leaders who would go into the communities and speak, and they would expect the example of these leaders to result in success at the ballot box.
Am I reading too much into it theorizing that because a lot of these folks or their grandparents or their parents or their great grandparents mm-hmm. came to the United States for mm-hmm. economic reasons, right? I mean, this is the story of immigrants that the idea of seeing a Hispanic name on money had some type of like, I don't know, a greater resonance. I mean, you know, Donald Trump totally. Desperately wanted to sign all the checks. I mean, there's a reason why people want to do that.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, so the thing that Romana Acosta Bañuelos would say over and over on the campaign trail, really, it's just her, they would tell narratives about their own personal experience. So over and over, she told stories on the campaign trail to newspaper reporters about how she entered the United States with 36 cents in her pocket. She started a tortilla factory with her aunt. They moved to East Los Angeles, and it eventually became one of the largest Mexican food distributors in the Southwest and in the United States. And that it's still open. So the company now is in, I believe, Gardena, California, and they still have hanging on the wall some of the original samples of dollar bills signed by the company's founder. So for sure, there is this pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality that Republican presidents really wanted to tap into. I mean, part of what they liked about part of what Nixon and his administration liked about Bañuelos is that she was a business owner. She started with nothing and, you know, became a very successful businesswoman. After she started the tortilla company, she founded banks in East Los Angeles that served the Mexican American community, some of the first Mexican American owned banks in California. And then, you know, they, during the Chicano movement, the kind of civil rights movement for Latinos, she was very much a non-radical. She wasn't arguing for the kind of liberation of the Southwest, or reclaiming the Southwest from Mexico, as many other Chicanos were. And she wasn't kind of arguing for, gender equality at all. She very much, you know, talked about her role as a homemaker as well. So, you know, I think all of these are signals that the administration wanted to send to the Hispanic community, and they thought that they had really chosen someone who could kind of represent the successful immigrant experience to other Hispanics. And I think that, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about Bañuelos, but I think that's more or less what they want to do with Ortega and Villalpando and Rosario Marin during the Bush 2 years as well. So for sure.
All right. I want to get to Joe Biden's outreach or lack of outreach in a moment. But getting back to Ronald Reagan gives a pathway for 2 million Mexican Americans or Latin American, you know, immigrants to citizenship. He, I mean, you ticked out Puerto Rican independence. I mean, these are almost diametrically opposed to, and they are. I mean, you know, like Donald Trump
totally,
doesn't, never mind providing Puerto Rico independence. He won't even provide. Pushing for the deportation of DACA recipients, like, you know, this is how is it that Donald Trump can maintain almost the same percentage of voters of Hispanic voters when Reagan attracted them presumably through these measures, and Donald Trump is running so contrary to them? And it's also, you know, it's not like there's huge hue and cry out of the Republican Party, like, please stop doing this. I mean, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah. It is a big mystery, isn't it? And yeah, it's, it's kind of amazing. And the explanation I came up with is a developing sense of loyalty to the party over individual candidates over a long period of time, because otherwise it's not explicable really, right? I mean, on issue over issue after issue, political scientists find that Latinos kind of just skew liberal. And how is it then that approximately the same percentage of Hispanics support someone like Trump as supported George H.W. Bush, who was a Republican leader of a much different kind? So I'll tell you like one quick story about an interview I did with one Hispanic Republican leader in 2015, just right after Trump announced his candidacy. And at that point, they didn't love Donald Trump. He didn't love Donald Trump, but he said that even if I don't love Donald Trump personally, I'm not going to let one man ruin the movement that I and others have spent decades building. So that to me struck me, because it was exactly the opposite logic that Reagan's Hispanic campaign advisors used in the late 1970s. So that's kind of where I really came up with this idea about the shift that I'm trying to explain is the shift from man over party to party over man. So loyalty is one of the ways it just makes sense to me that Hispanic Republicans continue to support Republican candidates despite all of the changes within the Republican Party. So Puerto Ricans, for example, they still, you know, the main issue for Puerto Rican Republicans on the island, and there is a Puerto Rican Republican Party on the island, and Puerto Rican Republicans in the United States, is pushing for statehood. That has seemed like a possibility at earlier moments in the history that I write, like namely the George H.W. Bush administration, when George Bush the first kind of used his State of the Union address to vocally and personally support statehood for the island. And that really kind of set off a flurry of activity in San Juan and Washington to try to make it a reality. That's a whole other story. But now, you know, you have a candidate who, well, now a president who was a candidate at the time, you know, joked about how he would push to make Puerto Rico a state only if Puerto Rico could guarantee him two Republican senators. So, you know, it's a dramatic shift in the Republican Party, yet the Puerto Rican Republicans, both on the island and the mainland, still have the territorial status of the island and the push to make it a state as their foremost goal. And I think that that's representative of the experience of a lot of Latinos, because they're really hanging on to these core issues like statehood or anti-communism or free enterprise. And no matter how much Trump slights them, I mean, on Twitter, in speeches, in
policy,
the beginning of his campaign. Yeah, go ahead.
In policy and in
yeah.
So let me ask you this. Is there also a big age divide on these issues?
Yeah.
Because it feels like there's a lot of people who are sort of that, you know, like I said, it took a long time for the Civil Rights Act to sort out, you know,
yeah.
for a lot of people, like, you know, what party they belong to. You know, there was still this big tradition for in the South of, you know, I'm Democrat because my daddy was a Democrat and his daddy was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they wake up one day and they realize, like, wait a second, the Democrats aren't the Democrats that I remember and the Republicans aren't the yep. Republicans I remember. I mean, is that happening with Hispanic voters? Are when we talk about Hispanic Republicans, are we talking about primarily people over the age of blank?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. The first thing I'll say is that this is a super interesting issue that is really important for the Latino electorate, for understanding the Latino electorate that also still needs so much more attention in a kind of empirical, systematic, comprehensive way than it has gotten so far. So, you know, you hear a lot of things about the Latino youth. First, it's Latino youth who are kind of really upping the Democrats' registration efforts. There's a great kind of project by PRI and the World's radio network out of Boston, program out of Boston, that they have a program called Every 30 Seconds. And the idea is that every 30 seconds, a Latino turns 18 and is becoming eligible to vote, and that that's going to be the thing that really shifts politics in the United States as the Latino population continues to grow. So there's a lot of attention to youth, but I don't think there are great kind of systematic studies. I think, you know, things like, we know this anecdotally from even the Democratic primary, where it tended to be Latino youth who were driving support for Bernie Sanders and kind of older Latinos who were still supporting Joe Biden. We also know stories about from Florida about how it's younger Cubans who are kind of tilting the Latino vote in Florida. I would add Puerto Ricans to that story as well. But even that is kind of like an anecdotal understanding of it because of how Barack Obama did in 2008 and 2012. And then I should note that Donald Trump did better in 2016 in Florida among Latinos than Mitt Romney did in 2012. So things kind of moved back toward the Republican Party in 2016. And I've been really interested in this and have been doing some interviews with recent high school graduates from Southern Florida and talking to them about where their political understandings came from. And in many ways, they were shaped by their views have been shaped by their very conservative Latin American parents. And so they've embraced their parents' politics. So all of this is to say that it's a really important issue. I'm not as convinced as others seem to be that youth are going to skew things toward Democrats in a way that they haven't in earlier elections, but we'll see. I mean, anecdotal evidence suggests that they might.
All right. So let's talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden, apparently, I think it came out of his campaign that they said something to the effect of, like, we're just not worried about Hispanics or Latinos, I don't know if that's the subtext of it, but the implication is that their strategy is less through the Southwest and more through the Midwestern industrial states. And so that's where their focus is. They're not worried about Arizona because they're going to win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. I mean, I don't know. This is just what I've read. What's your take on this?
I haven't read that exact thing, but that would be a mistake, I think. I mean, I think, especially now that it seems like Arizona really could be a possibility for not only Joe Biden and the reclaiming of the White House, but also in the Senate when the race between Mark Kelly and Martha McSally. And, you know, I think Latino voters, because they represent such an important part of the electorate there, are going to be really important to Arizona and to the Southwest as a whole. So I think that would be a mistake. I mean, I don't personally, I guess this is just my opinion as an expert as a historian, but not an expert as a political strategist today. I would say that it would be a mistake to exclusively focus on the Midwest as the territory that Democrats need to reclaim. I think there's a really important national fight to be had in the West, in the Southeast, and other places. So I think that it would be a mistake to kind of ignore Latino voters because and other voters, I mean all voters across the nation, because you think that the key battleground is going to be in the Midwest. I think, you know, part of why this is important too is that we don't, you know, Democrats shouldn't want a close election. You know, we shouldn't want it to be electorally close because that makes it possible for Trump to contest the election and other things. They should try to, I think, really wage a national campaign.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder if the theory is simply on some level, we're not going to convince. I mean, because it sort of sounds like, you know, if somebody can say, I'm supporting Donald Trump because the Republican Party, you know, it's basically sunk costs, right? I've invested so much into this project, the Republicans, that I can't let go of it now. I mean, I remember interviewing a delegate at the RNC in 2004. He was, almost, it seemed to me, in the room in Madison Square Garden somewhat, I don't want to say famous, but a celebrity, because he was, people pointed to me, to him from a, you know, from various states. I was looking for a gay Republican who could explain to me at a time where George Bush was, you know, pushing for an amendment, to prevent gay people from marrying, like literally. They're like, I think there's somebody in California you could talk to, as I was holding up a sign. I went, I spoke to the guy, and I think he was probably in his mid-60s, and he almost started crying as I was talking to him about it. Like, he said, you know, if I leave the party, I was asking him, I don't know how you can stay in a party that literally is trying to write you into the Constitution as a second-class citizen. And he said, if I leave the party, who's here to reform it from the inside? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. But maybe that's not the way that this is going to get reformed.
Right. Yeah, totally.
I mean,
totally.
Let me put it this way. How do you convince somebody who's holding white knuckled onto this part of their identity, right? That they're a Republican. We have invested all this money into, you know, or time or resources or energy or emotion into changing, you know, the Republican Party. And I am a Republican chair of my county, whatever it is, because, you know, like, how do you convince those people? Or do you just basically say, we got to write that off and look for our votes other places?
No, I think this is where also, you know, a difference between national messaging from the president differs from what's happening on the ground in particular places. I mean, Latinos in Florida are being told by the RNC that they really matter to the party, even as Donald Trump is sending very mixed messages about how much they matter. The same thing happens in Puerto Rico, where, you know, the party leaders of the Republican Party in Puerto Rico are, you know, waging campaigns in all the states because they participate in primary elections, but they don't participate in the general election. So the way that they exert some measure of national influence is by literally getting on planes and going to Nebraska or Florida or New York and kind of lobbying for their issues at the state level when they don't think they're getting a warm national reception. So I think part of it has to do with the difference between national messaging and kind of statewide messaging. And you know, Trump, I think, is as we've known all along. I mean, he's paying much more attention to how his base feels than how, you know, the broader Republican coalition feels. But then that's where you have, I mean, the White House today, even today, I mean, they haven't given up on Latinos in any way. I mean, they have people who work in the Office of Public Liaison who still today are putting together, you know, conference calls for Latino business owners to talk about how Donald Trump is the one who's really fighting for them to kind of get them through this difficult pandemic time. And Donald Trump, through the Small Business Administration, has done more for them than any other president in history. So I don't think they've given up on this electorate at all. I think they've, you know, been hard pressed sometimes to defend some of the national leaders' statements, but I think that they would still try to convince Latinos that it's the Republican Party that is representing their interests. I mean, the RNC has been doing this for decades explicitly, where they've been paying workers to show up to Latino events across the country and talk about how it's the Republican Party that supports or that will, you know, help them buy homes or help them raise their wages. All of these kinds of things.
I imagine Mike Garcia in California's 25th district, who Katie Hill's old seat, is an example of that on some level. Just because we are maybe days away from getting a Supreme Court ruling on DACA, what is the perspective of, and you know, like, I vacillate between, like, thinking, you know, maybe, you know, broadly speaking, the political, I guess, conventional wisdom that Latinos and Hispanics, you know, necessarily weigh immigration issues as like a primary concern is maybe, you know, a mistake, and is maybe in and of itself a little bit, I don't know, I don't want to say bigoted, but a little bit presumptuous. But something like DACA just seems to me to be the lowest hanging fruit for, you know, for people in terms of like, you know, these were kids who were brought here and who don't, you know, they had no, there was no volition here. There was, and they don't know, you know, in many instances, the countries that they would be deported to. What, how does a Hispanic Republican look at DACA?
Man, these are really, really excellent questions, Sam. And so it really does feel like the lowest hanging fruit, doesn't it? I mean, these aren't just children who were brought without a choice in the matter. I mean, they've become high school graduates, college graduates, PhDs, you know, business owners, service men and women, all kinds of things. So they've, I mean, really, I mean, they're Americans. They've been Americans their whole lives. They don't know anything else. So, you know, I would say that DACA also has, widespread support nationally among Democrats and Republicans. I mean, so I can't help it, help but understand the president's opposition to DACA now, and his own position has shifted and his own willingness to support it or not has shifted in the past 4 years. I mean, I think I just can't help but think that he's seeing everything right now through a very narrow electoral lens and also making the wrong gamble in many cases. I mean, I think a gamble to oppose DACA now is only a gamble that has to do with really motivating, I hate to use the word base again because it's, right. That too is such an imprecise term, but that's the gamble he's making, I think. And, you know, this is kind of what I was referring to when I was talking about how Hispanic Republicans over the past 25 years have been increasingly hard pressed to justify their continued support for Republican candidates. And I think it's only in the past 25 years when Hispanic Republicans have had to so vocally state that immigration is not the only issue we care about. And in surveys, it ranks maybe third, fourth, fifth behind education, behind jobs, behind healthcare, then immigration is important. And that's always been true. I mean, Hispanics have always cared about other things besides or in addition to immigration. But I think the Hispanic Republicans have never had to state that so forcefully as they do now, right, as a justification for their continued support.
Well, it's a fascinating question. And I have a feeling that, you know, we could talk again in another 10 or 15 years and maybe we're at that point where, like, you know, people wake up one day and go like, maybe it's not just Donald Trump, but, it may take may take Tom Cotton to be president before, to the extent that, you know, there's going to be some sort of change in perspective.
It might be, you know, and I will say that over the past 50 years or so, ever since African Americans fled the Republican Party, Americans, Democrats in particular, have been kind of waiting for this similar moment when Latinos would finally decide that the Republican Party is not the party for them and that they too would have the kind of mass exodus toward the Democratic Party that African Americans did in an earlier period. And it hasn't happened yet, but that is not to say that it won't happen in the future.
Geraldo Cadava, Associate Professor of History, Northwest University. The book is The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Really interesting. Thank you so much for your time. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. I'm going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And you help us produce this show every day. So you can become a member, support the show, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Our merch store is open. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Hoodies, the masks, the hat, the mugs, the bandanas, the t-shirts, the stickers, all of it. We're getting compliments on all of it. Go out and show your colors. And remember, the masks are all the proceeds. All of our proceeds go to supporting the Pacific Northwest West Immigration Rights Organization. And so every time you buy a mask, these crew of lawyers and et cetera, in the Pacific Northwest, you're helping them do their job too, which is to help immigrants deal with the crap storm that is the United States immigration process and CPB and ICE and all of it. So check that out. And what else we got? Don't forget tomorrow night, TMBS. You can find out the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube Live tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern. That's youtube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. You can sign up at Patreon, patreon.com/TMBS.
Yep, we have
Is it Chomsky on this week?
Yep, a little guy named Noam Chomsky, who's very in demand these days. So we got him tomorrow.
A lot of people emailing him, I hear.
Exactly. I was one of them this morning.
Did you really?
I did, yeah.
Oh, my God.
He's very prompt.
He's going to be exhausted. Did he email you back?
Immediately afterwards, basically.
How does he do that?
I have no idea. He's a linguistics master, so.
I wonder if there's like a little bit of Andy Warhol going on here. Didn't Warhol just like have people like, reproducing his art for him at one point? No, it's not Warhol. I'm sorry.
How dare you?
I know. I got a mistake. There was another dude who was doing that.
No, Warhol was vacuous dickhead and Chomsky is a man of the people, so. I strongly doubt that he would have people answering emails for him.
I was teasing, Jamie.
I don't even joke about that, Sam.
All right.
You triggered Jamie, Sam.
I did trigger Jamie. Check out Nomiki's show. You can find it at patreon.com. The Nomiki Show. You can find it on YouTube, youtube.com. The Nomiki Show. And Jamie, on the Antifada, what do you got this week?
Hello. So... this week on the Antifada, we had our 100th episode. Wow. For which, just limping over the finish line on that one. We did our
finish line.
Well, no, but a milestone, limping over the mile marker that's labeled 100 for 100 episodes. We did some analysis of the uprisings going on all over the country, talked about some of our own experiences in protests and marches recently, and that came out on Wednesday. Then on Friday, we had a free bonus. Normally, bonuses are for patrons, but we made this one free. We answered some questions from the listeners. Also, on Friday, we did a Twitch stream with the Lion Goes Down crew, that is Post Cyborg and Dickophrenic, our friends, our Lion Goes Down friends, wrote a really amazing analysis of the political economy of the COVID crisis. We talked about that and, how that ties in with the uprisings happening right now. And that is still up on Twitch for anybody who wants to watch it. Also, next week or this week, what week? I don't even know anymore. But we've got an interview with someone reporting from the CHAZ coming out, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. So we can get a little on-the-ground reportage from that. And I also interviewed one of the people involved with the Mutual Aid Hub that sprang up in Minneapolis with goods that may or may not have been liberated from Target. So check all that out, folks. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
And Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Yesterday on twitch.tv/literary hangover, the first 8 chapters of James Fenimore Cooper's The Pilot, the 1824 novel, which was the first sea tale about John Paul Jones, a privateer who harassed British shipping, which made the British Navy fleet lose its sense of security. Anyway, we talked about that we listened to that while I played Assassin's Creed Rogue and did a bunch of pirate stuff in that game.
Great. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Also, don't forget, check out the AM Quickie. Check that out, amquickie.com. We've got the IMs up. If you have the app at majorityapp.com, totally free. You can IM the show. And we have the calls up at 646-257-3920. I think we are all set for our journey into the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.